brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. On this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast, Rob from our Discord community joins us alongside his son Norman, who grew up with his dad Rob and his brother as well playing war games. So it's the first father and son team that we've had on the podcast talking about their hobby together. Really good conversation. So I kicked things off by asking Norman about the games that he grew up playing, the games that he plays these days, and just a wee bit about his hobby in general. Let's get into it.
Sure. So I guess I've mostly tended more towards the ancients and medieval side of things. What I've been playing mostly at the moment, and my time has been a little limited since I also have I now have a new baby in the house. But mostly what I've been playing lately is DBA, De Bellis Antiquitatis, in one form or another. That's a game we've been playing for quite a while. The fantasy version Hordes of the Things was kind of commonplace growing up, but I have other projects in store too. I have carrying on the family imaginations tradition with some sort of 19th century imaginary countries. And of course, there's a bit of, you know, fantasy skirmish in the mix as well. So those are the three main ones at the moment.
How much, before I want to obviously dig into your hobby origin story as well, Rob, but how often do you guys typically get to roll some dice together at the moment?
At the moment, it's been a little slow. In his adult phase, Norman now lives about 2 hours' drive from me. So it's a significant commitment to go down for a weekend, but several times a year at least, I suppose. He's within range that he's come up for the club's convention, local convention in the fall. So we've had some opportunity to play games at that point. We are having the baby's first birthday in a couple of weeks, but it's doubtful that we'll actually squeeze a game in on the side of that since they're entertaining relatives on both sides of the family.
Yeah, I think it'll be a little tight there. Yes, it's been a long time since I've been up for a regular club meeting, but I do try to make it up to the convention in the fall.
So Rob, talk to us a wee bit about you getting into the hobby in the first place. I mean, was your dad a war gamer, or is that something you discovered on your own?
Somewhere in between. So my father is a model railroader, and therefore I spent my childhood being taken to the general purpose hobby shops as they were constituted in the United States in the 1970s, which meant that they had plastic model kits, model trains, slot car racing, and a bunch of other things that might have been in there. I gravitated toward the boxes of Airfix plastic soldiers. So as a result of that, somewhere in, I guess in the fifth grade, which is to say that I was about 10, when one of my classmates admitted that he also had some Airfix soldiers and he actually had some rules available to play games with them. So I was introduced that way, but the material was available in the hobby shop. And since I was the probably most prolific buyer of Airfix plastic soldiers that was a regular child at that store, when they got a demonstration copy of an American magazine called the Wargamer's Digest, which was published from, 1973 to 1980 or so, I got handed the sample copy, and that connected me to the outside world of the rest of gaming. I knew that there was, suddenly knew that there was a lot going on. I was able to track down a few of the hardcover rule books. So on other podcasts, we would say that I'm a classic member of the Airfix generation. So if it hadn't been for my father and his model railroading, I wouldn't have been probably introduced to wargaming, but he's not directly involved in this.
Before we started recording, you mentioned a game called Hordes of the Things. Norman, do you want to tell us a wee bit about Hordes of the Things, please?
Sure. So it's I would say it's a set for fantasy rules, but it ends up being a little more versatile than that. So it's an offshoot of the DBA system, but it's a multiple based fantasy game. You have 12 units or 12 elements, which are made up of some sort of standard types. So you have, you know, spears or blades or knights or, you know, riders for your light horse. And with the fantasy version, of course, there's also a mix of behemoths for all your large stomping monsters, from ogres to tanks to whatever. Magicians who can throw magical blasts at a distance. Flyers, dragons. So obviously you can play sort of, I'll call it standard fantasy games with this, but people have also been very creative in adapting these rules to pretty much anything. The one I remember was seeing a World War I version with, you know, gods as clouds of gas crossing the field. And
magicians as artillery, probably, in that one.
Probably so. There is actually artillery, but I've never had much luck with it in that set. So
can that game be played at any scale?
Yeah. In fact, we played it at several scales growing up. Dad had a set of 6mm armies, which we played quite a lot. These days, I mostly play it with 20mm or 1/72 scale plastics. But we've done other ones as well. I know at one point, my brother and I, we had a bunch of Lego, and we put together Lego armies for Hordes of the Things with, you know, all our available minifigs, pretty much.
What age were you and your brother when you sort of started properly getting involved in war games then?
I would have probably been about 6 or so. One of the other things I remember is that Dad and a couple of his friends came in a few times to our classroom to put on games. I guess you had some sort of a volunteer arrangement with our teachers. So I remember in second grade, we were studying the American Civil War, and you had collected a bunch of figures for a Battle of Gettysburg. So I remember doing that. That's maybe like the earliest I can put a definite date to.
Yeah, I didn't actually take any notes at the time. Your first dice rolling goes back before the start of my continuous recording of games. I've got a log of all of my miniatures games back to 99. But as you were probably 5 or 6 when you first rolled dice in earnest, as opposed to some pre-war games that we might have done, yeah, involving, you know, throwing things at toy soldiers, that didn't end up recorded in the logbook. So it would be hard to put a finger on it now.
Rob, how do you? I mean, I know it's a few years ago now, but when you're in the position to start introducing the kids to your games, obviously there's this tension between, like, it's really great to get them involved, but also, you really want to protect your miniatures and that. So can you remember much of the balancing act there? Did you have some miniatures that you were happier to get a bit more knocked about?
Well, to be perfectly honest, in the earliest stage, we played with unpainted 54mm plastics. That way, I didn't have to worry about it at all. So I'm not sure when we introduced them to... introduce you to games with my actual painted figures. We might have actually been playing with those 6mm fantasy figures. They're relatively durable, not too many things sticking out on them to be squished by little fingers.
Yeah, that seems pretty likely, thinking back.
We also had the home cast figures, although I do know from having looked it up recently that the first game anybody played with those was in 1996. I cast my own figures, so if we break a home cast figure, it can just go back in the pot. I mean, I'll be a little distressed for the loss of the painting time, but at least I didn't lose any money on the miniature.
Mm-hmm. Norman, what are some of your memories then, growing up and sort of getting into wargaming and miniatures?
Well, aside from playing games with Dad, we would go to the big local conventions. These would be the HMGS East conventions in our area. So Historicon in the summer and Cold Wars in the winter. And they would have, at least in those days, they had a special kids room, actually, where, you know, you could be dropped off and play some simple games and try your hand at painting some miniatures. So one I remember particularly playing, actually, was a game called Fuzzy Heroes, where actually you brought your stuffed animal, your teddy bear or whatnot, and there was a way to stat it out based on its size and color and, you know, number of claws and so forth. And then you would pit them against all the other kids who had brought theirs. We actually ended up buying a copy of this, and in classic Power Gamer fashion, went through our large collection of stuffed animals to find the ones that were most fearsome under the rules. I think the best one was a scorpion who, you know, with his 10 legs and his stinger, had quite the stats.
I would note that Fuzzy Heroes is actually still available on Wargames Vault, if anybody wants to take a look at that. They played a stripped-down version of it at the conventions. The actual game is rather more complicated than it sounds like it should be for something where seven-year-olds are playing with stuffed animals.
Did you do much painting in the early days, Norman?
Oh, I certainly tried. I remember, hanging out and watching Dad paint his miniatures and going back and trying to do the same. There's not many surviving examples from that era. They're a little blobby, even for some years after that. But yeah, we had little bottles of craft paint, and I guess I'm not sure what we were using for brushes. Probably something fairly expendable, but
something inexpensive from the craft store. Yes.
Yes.
Brushes bought in packages of five or six.
But I remember having some of those accurate knights in 54 and attempting to, paint some little heraldry on the shields even then.
Yeah, I don't know when you finally surpassed me, but certainly by the time you were in college, your painting was well above mine.
On the gaming front, Rob, through the years, how have the games looked in terms of, are you generally playing against one another? Has somebody taken on the role of games master? Like, talk to us a wee bit about that.
So it will depend. As noted, we play the War Games Research Group, DBA, and Hordes of the Things rules, and those are always played head-to-head competitively. Lately, most recently, Norman has been the one to be setting up some sort of tournament elimination brackets, so we have spent a lot of time figuring out which armies are the best by pitting them against each other. We're playing competitively for each game, but overall, we'll swap armies back and forth, so we're not always playing the same army. We're not attached to the armies too much in that sense. We didn't have anything like Rangers of Shadowdeep back in the day, so there were no cooperative miniatures games as such. Well, at some point we need to talk about the Not Quite 7 Years' War. In that, our armies have always been allies. This is one of our Imaginations campaigns for 18th century stuff done with Prince August homecast figures. So both Norman and his brother have troops for that. And our little batch of troops, as I say, constitutes an old alliance our troops never actually appear against each other on the table. Other members of the gaming club also have armies, so they are the opponents most of the time. Sometime, about 2010, so rather late in all of this, we picked up a couple of reasonably well-painted armies that somebody was disposing of from a very similar project, which apparently didn't click for them, although we've been doing this now for the better part of 30 years. And we use those as the opponent forces. So if we're going to play a game of that at home, it may be my troops and Norman's troops against these other two countries. One of us will have to play them, but it's not like we're fighting each other. So it's sort of a variable question.
Yes, I think one of the main sort of missing elements here is the club, right? The Hawks, which you were more or less a founding member of and I grew up in. So that was kind of the other main outlet for gaming. We would go to the biweekly meetings pretty regularly.
What does Hawks stand for, sorry?
Sure, that's the Hartford Area Weekly Kriegspielers.
Good.
We had to play around a little bit with acronyms to come up with something that sounded good. So Harford County, Maryland is where the club is based out of. So that's where the Harford in there. And a lot of people are from outside the area. So the Harford area. Weekly was aspirational. Our meetings were always every other week, even back in the day. But even to this day, the club has a lot of, what shall I say, sidebar invitational games that are going on. So these days, for example, most of the retirees in the club, or many of the retirees in the club, will meet for a game on Thursday mornings, which, since I'm still in the working world, I'm not available for yet, but that day is coming soon. which we fondly refer to as the geezer games. So with everything going on, we probably approach, there's something going on weekly for club members. And the K for Kriegspielers, well, we had to have something that filled it out. And that just gave a gave us a mascot and all of the rest of that stuff. So
I suppose it's for the best you didn't go with G for gamers. You could have been the Hogs.
Yeah, I would just as soon not be the Hogs if I had a choice. But acronym play was my thing. So while I was not one of the actual founding members, I do have the distinction of being the guy that came up with the name. So it has stuck these sometime this year is the 30th year. So it was founded originally in 1994.
With running a club like this, Rob, I know you're saying that weekly wasn't necessarily the case, but still very regular. How much work is it in between sessions? Because, I've never been part of a War Games club, but I'm assuming it's only half the battle to turn up with your miniatures and get them on the table. Like, you need to know what you're playing, you need to know what the scenario is. Like, that seems to me a lot of work away from the table. So, am I right on that front?
Well, you are, and you are. But the way that our club is unusual, and that almost deserves a whole session by itself. We were originally formed when somebody didn't have enough opponents, and he thought, well, if I can't find an opponent, I will train some. So he offered a how to play war games course at the local community college. I don't know if they have the equivalent of those in the UK, but these are usually two-year institutions funded by some local agency, and they often offer, as part of their community services, some sort of miscellaneous enrichment classes for adults. So you might go there and take a watercolor class or photographic darkroom work back in the day. So he offered this wargaming class, and of the six people that showed up, four of them were already wargamers. They also looked at the class in the catalog and thought, oh, I might be able to find some opponents if I went there. So when the actual class was done, they started meeting at people's houses. We retain to this day a casual approach to organization. We usually refer to that as the O word and don't use too much of it. But we discovered early on that randomly a lot of the guys in the club were putting on games at the larger conventions around here, and therefore they were usually looking for some place to test out their scenarios and so forth that they were going to take to the conventions. So we have a large pool of people who have a game and could put on one on a Friday night. So generally speaking, it's the actual level of organization goes to the, okay, we need a game for next Friday. Who's got something they want to run? And somebody will step up and say, yes, we can playtest my World War I square bashing scenario, which is a set of rules from Peter Pig over in the UK. For the next convention, everybody agrees that if we show up, we will happily play whatever somebody else wants to put on the table. So I don't know how you would replicate it, but we have developed a culture of openness. The expectation is that if you show up, you're happy to play at least one of the games that's there. We typically have, not unusually, have two games. I guess attendance has been fluctuating, and I'm a little on the fluctuated outside at the moment. I need to do something about that. Tomorrow night is a club meeting, so I need to make sure I get to it. But organization only extends to the filling up the calendar for a meeting or two in advance for the most part. I guess when we get to the point where we don't have volunteers to run the game, then it will be time to fold up the club. But 30 years in and we haven't gotten there yet.
On the subject of your gaming as well, you talked about the imagination stuff. What appeals to you about that versus, just playing in factual history, if you like?
I like having a little bit of wiggle room, both with, the uniforms and so forth, and with the history itself. You don't have to, you're not confined in quite the same way, but you can take inspiration from whatever you like.
So we could adopt a scenario from an actual Seven Years' War battle. We could adopt a scenario from a War of 1812 battle. And you wouldn't... It causes me not to sit there thinking, oh, these guys ought to have shakos instead of tricorns. It's just the Battle of Schlegelsburg or what have you. But yes, I've also enjoyed the painting my own uniforms. I try to keep mine relatively historical-ish. I don't use any colors that would tend to turn people's heads, but some of the guys in the club have painted their tricorn guys with, you know, bright purple uniforms with yellow facings and so forth.
Even mine are running around in a sort of terracotta orange color, so it's not exactly historical.
Do you both enjoy the world building aspect away from the table, coming up with ideas, backgrounds, and things like that?
I would say so, especially the map making. There's been a lot of mapping over the years of various countries. So,
how does that work then? When you're making maps, how do you do it?
It depends. I certainly started off doing it by hand. I think Dad still prefers it that way. I sometimes these days will use software for mapping, but mostly just to make something that looks good. It's occasionally we've dipped into trying to make maps to use with wargaming campaigns, but that hasn't always. We make more maps than we play games when it comes to those, I feel like. So
Norman also has a tendency with his ability to do computer things to be able to whip out a map that looks more like it's been printed in the period than anything that I would scroll on the back of an envelope. I've been doing lately fantasy maps for various fantasy campaigns, following instructions in a book by a guy named Jared Blando called "Making, you know, How to Draw a Fantasy Campaign Map" or something like that.
Our question of the month for May 2024 is, what rules have you created or adapted to improve your favourite gaming system? This might be a homebrew rule or something you've ported over from another game. The point is, you tried it, it worked well, and you kept on using it. Head on over to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail to submit your answer. That's bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now, back to the show. I imagine, like, if you make pretty detailed maps that have a lot of variety on them, you maybe need the terrain collection to back it up. Is that ever an issue?
So we're not usually mapping at the battlefield level. We're ordinarily drawing maps at the country or county level. I mean, I have a reasonably extensive terrain collection, and Norman can speak, but his is not small compared to the amount of space that he needs to cover with it.
No, but we typically piggyback off of you when we need terrain for a larger game.
Yeah, and if you were going to put something on at a convention in the context of the club, of course, one of the advantages of being in the club is that we borrow terrain back and forth. So we can pool up 15 players worth of terrain if we absolutely need to.
Starting with you, Norman, what is your hobby setup, if you have one, look like? Do you have an area for gaming, an area for painting? And is that something you have to put down and put away, or have you got something a bit more permanent?
It's fairly permanent at the moment. I have a painting desk, which is set up all the time. I have a set of shelves with all my miniatures and terrain and everything on them. But the actual gaming table, I have a set of folding tables that come out when we actually want to play a game.
What size is your table?
I guess it ends up being 5x6 with both tables deployed. You have two of these kind of what here would be standard banquet tables. So they're 2.5x6 feet.
So more than enough room for anything you want to play then?
It gets a little cramped with the larger figures if we're having a big game on them, but we've certainly done that too.
What about your own setup, Rob? What does that kind of look like?
So back in 2018, we moved into an old house with a lot of small rooms. Unfortunately, I'm not able to set up a table permanently, with one exception that I'll get to. And therefore, I'm also on folding tables. I have not actually enough space in this house to set up the two tables and make my own 5x6. So I have a 4-foot by 6-foot folding table, which can be set up here in a space I call the library, but it's my my shelves of books, my desk that I paint at, also in between times, my desk that I do work from home at, which means I do need to clean up the painting in order to be ready to set my computer up and go to work the next morning. My miniatures are mostly stored in really useful boxes, and I have those on heavy-duty shelving in the basement. So if we're going to play a game, I'll go down and recover the 3 or 4 boxes that we need with today's miniatures. I actually have one of those fancy gaming tables that doubles as a dining room table. The downside of that, as I have discovered now that I've been living with it for about 4 years, is that you need it as a dining room table a lot more often than you need it as a gaming table. And therefore, it is usually covered with a tablecloth and has our miscellaneous dinner service set on it. It's also got a table topper, which is almost too heavy for a single person to, it's too heavy for a single person to get off the table. Once it's off the table, I can move it around. So just to open that table and lay something out is a two-person operation. And therefore, it's been eaten on as a dining room table many more times than it has been opened up and used as a gaming table. Can think of that as a cautionary tale for anybody who covets one of those things. So that has a total gaming space on it of 3-foot by 5-foot, and therefore we play smaller games on it. I'm kind of pivoting back to 6mm this year so as to get a little more play space, if you will, out of that smaller table. But I've got pictures of setting up 40mm games on there with relatively small size units of say 12 infantry or 6 cavalry. And you can get 6 or 8 units on there and have a satisfactory little skirmish. But it does look a little tight at that point. If we go to a club meeting, the standard club table that we're using is 4 of those banquet tables set up in a 6-foot by 10-foot configuration. So I always think of that as the standard game, but I haven't been able to set up a 6x10 table at home at any time in the 30 years that I've been in the club.
How has your miniature collection evolved over time in terms of the models that you've added to it, the stuff that you've focused on and painted, you know, even the mediums that they're made from?
So I guess growing up, I had we had a big bucket of toy soldiers, more or less. These are mostly plastic 54s with a sprinkling of the smaller 20mm 1/72 figures in there. I always found that I really didn't like working with metal. You know, having to trim and file the metal figures was not something I enjoyed. So I've tended to stick with plastic throughout my hobby lifetime so far. I've shifted more towards the smaller 20mm figures. I also do have a collection of Reaper Bones figures for D&D or Frostgrave or other sort of fantasy skirmish games. They're all individually based instead of multiply based. But there's a few outliers in there. I do have some 6mm figures that were originally intended to go with the family Hordes of the Things collection. I do have a unit of, well, more than a unit, an army of the 40mm home cast, not quite 7 years war figures, though those mostly are garrisoned with dad, so.
You should also note that when you say plastic, you are almost uniformly referring to soft plastic.
Yes, yes. I've never really gotten to the multi-part hard plastics either. Yes, having sort of settled on 20mm as my scale, it means I can, you know, reuse a lot of the terrain and so forth. So I haven't really branched out from that.
And what about yours, Rob?
So currently I have things in, I guess,
15mm.
Everything but 15mm, yes. I've got some 54mm plastics. I've got a nice setup for a medieval skirmish game. We've got about 100 figures and enough scenery to fill a 5x6 table conveniently for that. In the 40mm, which is all, primarily home cast, I have a historical French and Indian War setup. We've got the Imagination's Not Quite 7 Years War with the Prince August semi-flat figures. And I've got a 40mm Renaissance game. Yeah, that's a story in itself, so we'll leave that one off. But it's another home cast setup. The existence of a set of molds meant that I had to have them and had to cast something with it. And having cast the figures, I had to have some sort of game to go along with it. My 25mm collection, 25-28mm collection, is basically all metal. The earliest pieces of that were things that I acquired as early as 1974 or 75. So most of my fantasy figures are what you would call a true 25 or old 25. They wouldn't fit in very well with an old world setup if I were to put them on the table there. My humans would look like halflings and my halflings would look like tiny little fairies, I guess. I have molds for those too, at least some of them. 6mm is all lead. I've got the 72nd scale plastics in the current family style. The one I also don't do multi-part plastic kits. That seems like a fine way to end up with tiny little heads attached to my fingers indelibly. Inevitably, it has gone wrong, and I just stopped trying to do it. So there's a lot of modern development that has just passed me by because I'm not willing to work with the multi-part plastics. I know everybody in the modern world loves them, but I'll be a curmudgeon about that one.
What's the reason? Is it a deliberate reason to have avoided 15 mil then?
I didn't actually avoid 15 mil. I started in the late 80s doing 15 millimeter ancients, but I came to the conclusion that from my point of view, they were sort of at the anti-sweet spot. They were too small to paint in detail easily, but too big to just gloss over like you could with a 6mm. So I was having a hard time painting them to a level that I thought was attractive. So basically I just stopped. Nowadays I've taken to using magnification. I've got an optivisor set up that goes over my reading glasses. I have painted some wild things on some 6mm figures occasionally, so I could probably do 15s if I wanted to. But having gotten away from it, that's also a set of, it means I only need buildings in a few scales. Having a 15mm building collection would be one scale too many as far as storage goes.
The subject of Rangers of Shadowdeep came up earlier on. Norman, have you played much of that so far?
I have not. We had a club game going for a while it was Frostgrave and then Frostgrave Ghost Archipelago, and then we branched into Stargrave briefly, but I have not done any of the Rangers of Shadowdeep.
How have you found the Joe McCulloch games, Frostgrave, Stargrave, Ghost Archipelago?
I've enjoyed them. Part of that may have been, the chance to get together with everybody and throw some dice on a regular basis, but they're certainly a serviceable set of skirmish rules.
I'm not absolutely certain that Joe McCulloch would have approved of our playing with six-player multiplayer games. It can take a little while to get back around to your turn in a six-player setup. But that was how many people we had who wanted to play.
I also found it kind of interesting the focus on acquiring treasure instead of actually fighting each other. I became a little bit infamous, perhaps, for my single-minded attention to collecting treasures and avoiding combat. So,
yeah, I don't remember what the standings were in the last campaign, but I knew when I saw those in the Stargrave campaign, as soon as those drones started coming out, I knew I wasn't collecting any of those treasures. So,
as we approach the end of our time limit, then, is there anything that we've not covered that you guys would like to touch on before we get it wrapped up?
I think Norman should say something about his early days as a game master. This goes along with being raised in the club and the club's general expectation that everybody ought to be able to run a game.
Oh, let's see. Well, I guess that's... So the earliest game I remember playing was earliest game I remember running was Aztecs versus Conquistadors. This is something we ended up with a great quantity of the Revell 20mm figures, and I had painted some to my standards at the time. And so at the convention, actually, the club used to have a kids table where they would run games suitable for kids. And so I ended up being a kid running a game for other kids. So that was the earliest one. From there, there's been a few over the years, but we've had the Lego collection out on the table for a game or two. I've run a few things here and there, but
yeah, we kind of glossed over the Hawks with our focus on running games at conventions, and some years back with many of the older members being in a state where we had gaming children, we felt that it was our duty to put on something at the convention that kids would be able to play. So we usually had a track of kids games in our club room. That's also another, I feel like, is almost a story for a different time. But at the conventions, we have arranged with the convention organizers to put all of our club's activities in one space, so that we could swap the scenery back and trade the scenery back and forth easily, and so forth. This probably encouraged us to run more games than would otherwise have been the case. But the kids' table has sort of fallen off in recent years. We haven't quite evolved to the point where it's the grandkids' table.
Well, I would say it's evolved too. I guess the current incarnation of it is the Armies for Kids project, which we are actually painting figures for that just the other month. So this is one where the club collects donated figures from various sources and puts them together into a suitable game for kids, and then basically splits up the armies and terrain and everything into sets that can be handed out to the players afterwards as a sort of starter kit.
So this year we're handing out, I believe, six sets of matched American Civil War armies in 72nd scale plastic with a, let's say, a quick paint job on them.
I think the core of it was a collection donated by one of the club members, and then with additional figures to be painted out by everybody to sort of fill in the gaps there and make sure we had complete sets to hand out. But
cool. It's been a great chat, guys. I've really enjoyed it and appreciate your time. Is there anywhere you would like to send or point the listener to?
I am not up to date on my blog, but it is, you can see some of the pictures of our past activities. It's sharpbrush.blogspot.com.
Yes, mine is junkyardplanet@blogspot.com.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. If you enjoy the show, then please do share it with someone else you think might enjoy it too. And be sure to check out our Discord community of like-minded hobbyists, which you could find at bedroombattlefields.com/Discord. It'd be great to see you in there.